Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The art of political song, which has been crafted and heard worldwide since time immemorial, is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Songs of a political nature are not surprising, given the similarities and parallel community structures of politics and religions, with each community promoting the behaviors and concepts it supports as being the most appropriate. In this program, we visit with singer-songwriter David Rovics, a troubadour and folk musician of our time. He visited the studios of Radio Curious on December 9th, 2012. Our conversation began when David Rovics described his work, his songs, and how he creates them. You may learn more about him at www.davidrovics.com.
I'm definitely very much in the troubadour tradition, which is a long tradition, international tradition, where people sing other people's songs and write their own songs about what's happening in the world now and historically and tell stories about it. And that's definitely the tradition I'm from, which is actually a very mainstream musical tradition around the world. It's only in the recent century, in the past century, that we, in some countries, and especially in the West, we think of this tradition as being a sort of a marginal tradition or a tradition that's only practiced by certain sort of left-wing lunatics and stuff. But it's actually just the mainstream of the musical traditions around the world.
So tell us what drew you to this line of work.
It's kind of hard to say because there's so many different factors involved, but I grew up in a family of musicians. So I've been playing music and having music around me since I was a kid. When I was 12, I went to a summer camp in Massachusetts that was run by left-wing Unitarian anti-nuclear protesters, basically. Basically, I was exposed to this tradition.
The songs that you write yourself, is it fair to say that you write the music and the lyrics?
I write songs, and mostly I do my own songs. And the songs that I'm doing are the ones that are about current events are sometimes written from because I was there, if it's about an event that I actually participated in or witnessed or something. And other times it's songs written about events that I didn't actually witness personally, but read about in the news. And then if I'm writing about historical events, then of course it's usually something I did not experience myself, but I read about or heard about from people who did experience it. And then of course other songs I write that aren't necessarily about events, but are just about love or whatever. I mean, that's usually more from direct personal experience.
From that array of songs that you've written, could you give us a sample and tell us how it came to be?
Sure. Let's see. Yeah. I am a fisherman, so were my parents. Here in Cordova, on Prince William Sound, I'm not a tree hugger, but I love the mountains. And hauling in the gillnet, with the ocean all around, life was good here. You could raise a family with 100,000 tons of herring sent out every year. 1989, the tanker grounded. Nothing's ever been the same around here. Senator Stevens said, not one drop of oil would spill on Alaska's shores. And if it happened, it would be cleaned up. But our beaches were still covered, as was the ocean floor. For years past, each run collapsed. It was then we knew for sure the herring weren't coming back. Exxon's promises of compensation were about as empty as a used up paper sack. It was August 20th, 1993, when we fishermen decided something must be done. We packed some groceries, we made some banners,
headed out to Valdez Narrows, beneath the midnight sun. 100 vessels took to the water, pushed through a storm, and to the Valdez Sea we lined up our boats, formed a blockade, and we waited for whatever might be. Was approaching. It was a sight to see there in the twilight of the day. We saw it turning. We all cheered and cried as tanker after tanker after tanker turned away. A Coast Guard gunship from Seattle would take 3 days to get up to the Sound. We held the line till then. Then we went back home to Cordova, to this hallowed, oiled ground. I am a fisherman, so were my parents. Here in Cordova, on Prince William Sound.
And so the background of that song, for our listeners who may not know.
It's a song about an event that got very little coverage in the news at the time, and you know, pretty much none since then, which is the fishermen of Cordova, Alaska, blockaded Prince William Sound for 3 days, and oil tankers were circling on either side, spending $10,000 an hour to go in circles on either side of the blockade, and only after Coast Guard gunships were on their way and in coming into the Sound from Seattle, did the fishermen disband the blockade. And also only after they got a promise from Babbitt, Secretary Babbitt of the Interior Department, that $1 billion would be spent on researching the toxicity of oil, which is the only reason we now know how toxic oil is, because of direct experience with oil spills there in Alaska and because of the research that was funded by this $1 billion that wouldn't have existed if it weren't for the fishermen blockading the Sound 4 years after the Valdez oil spill.
And hearing you sing recently, you had a lot of comments from a political perspective that we don't usually hear. Can you share some of that with us?
The song? Sure. Let's see.
Private Manning was an analyst. If what they say is true, he was paid to read reports, find the patterns sifting through. As he read the data, the patterns did emerge. Patterns that were clear both before and since the surge. Patterns of abuse of the most horrific kind. Gunning down civilians out of view and out of mind. Gunning down the opposition in the middle of the night. Sending off the scholars to be tortured out of sight. Sometimes you need desperate measures when you live in desperate times. Private Manning saw he was looking at war crimes. He wondered what to do to allow the dead to speak. He finally decided to contact WikiLeaks. Now it's all out on the table and everybody knows. The emperor is naked, he's not wearing any clothes.
So there's the first verse of it.
You had another comment that caught my attention, and that was about ethnic cleansing. And you made a reference which seemed to make historical sense of the Catholic Church's ethnic cleansing of the people who lived in the Western Hemisphere. Mm. You referred to it, if I remember, as the biggest ethnic cleansing that went on for thousands of years. And personally, I don't like the term ethnic cleansing.
It was very much directed against all sorts of people who were who you might call ethnically white or whatever, you know, although we didn't have terms like that back then. And, you know,
it was either convert or be killed.
Yeah, convert or be killed.
And that's what happened in Iberia in 1491 and 1492.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, when King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella in 1492 decreed that all the Jews of Spain had to leave within 3 months or be killed. And their other option would be to convert. And those who converted were then killed a few years later because they were considered to be not completely converted. And so they therefore had to be killed. So, yeah, 600,000 Jews fled Spain in 1492. And, of course, where they went, which I think is also very interesting for a lot of reasons, is Istanbul, where they lived in peace and prosperity for 500 years, while in Europe their Jewish brethren were constantly being slaughtered in crusades, inquisitions, and in, of course, the most insane sort of manifestation of the crusader inquisitor mentality, German fascism, and then meanwhile in the Middle East, Jews were doing just fine. And then they have to all, and then the Zionist movement has to go and displace Palestinians and then create this whole ridiculous narrative about how Jews are unsafe in the Middle East. Jews are unsafe in Europe. Europe has a problem with anti-Semitism. Europe has a problem with Islamophobia. Europe has a lot of problems. And the Catholic Church specifically has a lot of problems, currently and historically.
Radio Curious has an interview with Richard Zimler about the last Kabbalist of Lisbon, a person who left Portugal in 1492 to go what was then Constantinople, now Istanbul. In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with a troubadour singer, David Rovics, in the studios of Radio Curious. You may learn more about him at www.davidrovics.com. I'm Barry Vogel. David, is there a song that you could share with us on the topic of what happened in the Western Hemisphere?
Yeah, the song that I wrote about that whole history is basically in the context of sort of describing the inspiration for Anders Breivik's massacre in Norway last summer. I mean, the year before last summer, and he was very much inspired by the crusaders and inquisitors of the 14th, 15th century and many other racists and fascists in Europe and North America since then. I'll just do a verse of it as a poem because it works that way and I don't have a cable. They say he acted alone for a Europe white and free, a sick and twisted man from an otherwise sane society, the image of Aryan blonde, almost iridescent, with a manifesto quoting from the Crusades to the present. But he stood on many shoulders, of this we can be sure, a millennia of xenophobes who slaughtered to be pure, since before the first Crusade, when a mighty Christian band hacked and stabbed and burned their way to the Holy Land. They say he acted alone, but in his mind he was another of those who came before him, his mighty Christian brothers, who rode covered in armor, served their masters well. They vowed to chastity. They vowed to kill the infidel. They marauded west and east in the name of Christendom. They killed Jews, Muslims, pagans, fellow Christians by the thousand in the name of Jesus. From the Jordan to the Rhine, the Red Cross on their chest plate, their terrifying sign in the shadow of the Knights Templar.
And you wrote that?
Uh-huh. And that's just the first verse.
When you write something, how does the process evolve, putting it together, the number of rewrites, fixing the music to go with it?
It usually starts with a hook line, with some kind of one short line that really encapsulates the subject that I'm trying to write about. And then usually once I have the hook line, then the next step is figuring out how the verses will fall around the hook line, what each verse is going to do, what its purpose in life is, and how it's going to relate to the hook line. In some way, it's always coming back to the hook line. One of the things a good song has to do is not say too much, because it's a very strict, very short sort of form of expression. And you can't make too many points in a song or tell more than one story, really, without the whole thing falling apart. It's not a novel. Once I have that framework in mind, then it's like just a matter of spending time with a notebook and nothing to do. And within a few hours or a few days of sitting there with a notebook, the verses will be written. Then the next step is figuring out how it's going to work musically. There's always a very clear idea in mind when I'm coming up with the verses about what kind of song this is going to be, if it's going to be a fast or a slow song, or if it's going to be a melancholy ballad, or if it's going to be a hard-hitting kind of anthemic thing. Or so I have some idea of how that's going to go, and of the meter and the rhythm, without necessarily having a clear idea of the melody. And then that comes later.
Can you tell us again the hook line of the poem form that you just said for us?
Yeah, the hook line there is "In the shadow of the Knights Templar." And that's what keeps on coming up at the end of every verse. So I'm always relating it to that influence while still talking about something different in each verse. So in that song in particular, in the first verse, I'm pretty much laying the background, and then in the second verse, I'm getting a bit more into the background, specifically focusing on the Pope and the Catholic Church. And then the verse after that, I get more recent and talk about recent Norwegian politics. And then in the last verse, I'm talking about very contemporary Norwegian politics.
So that format leaves the listener with a concept, a rhythm, a short phrase to take home and carry, as you would employ in a sing-along.
Yeah, yeah. A sing-along can be any song with a chorus, of course, but there's certain songs we think of more as sing-alongs because they're like really classic forms where there's a little bit of a room behind each line that somebody can shout out the next line. Like, you know, the sorts of songs that Pete Seeger is especially fond of, where, you know, that really work well as a sing-along. But basically, a sing-along is pretty much any song that people know the lyrics to. And whether it's a sing-along or not, those refrains, a good refrain or a really good line in a song, is going to stick in people's heads and become a sort of easy reference point for understanding reality around them.
It's got to be that every sing-along has the first time it's sung.
Exactly.
And creates its history.
Exactly.
In a way, is that what you do?
Sure. When I'm writing a song, you know, it may be destined to be a sing-along, but I won't know until it's gone out there in the world somehow.
What was the last one?
Oh, every time I write a song, I'm hoping it's going to go viral, and it's going to really catch people's attention out there in the internet. And I think for a song to work, every line has to be perfect. You can't have a dud in there. That breaks the spell. You can't have a bad rhyme. I'm not saying that I've accomplished that with all my songs, but if it's going to really work, it's got to be perfect. It's a degrees of perfection that make it really, really take hold.
Is there one that you would like to offer?
Oh, well, I mean, there's about 300 that I could offer, but...
Well, I think you'd have to choose.
Let's see.
300 that you've written.
Yeah. I grew up in Lawrence, there by the water, in the shadow of a textile mill. Sometimes I feel just like that building, empty but standing there still. I liked the president, I liked the union, I believed in the rights of man. So I signed up when it was time to fight Hitler, and they sent me off to Japan. I couldn't believe it. It was all just so bad. I kept my head down, tried to stay alive. I got shot in the leg, took me out of the action, so I was lucky enough to survive. I came home from the war, met a girl named Maria. We had ourselves a son. When I first saw Jim's face, the first thing I thought, I hope he never has to carry a gun. It was a long time ago, another life that I had, a little boy who called me dad. Terrible dreams of my time overseas, but otherwise, life was all right.
had a job and a wife and a fine little lad with eyes so cheery and bright. When his number came up, I said, let's move up north to Halifax. What do you say? But my Jim wouldn't have it. He said, if I'm gonna be drafted, I don't wanna run away. It was a long time ago, another life that I had, a little boy who called me dad. After just a few months, the letters stopped coming. Then one morning, a knock on the door. Two nervous young men handed me a flag, said your son died in the war. He gave his life for his country, was what the man said. He didn't believe it, and neither did I. I closed the front door, dropped the flag on the floor, and I sat down in Jim's room and cried. It was a long time ago, another life that I had, a little boy who called me dad. It was less than a year when my wife said to me, you look so much like our little Jim. She had to go. I don't blame her, you know. I also remind me of him. Now it's been 40 years. I'd be a grandpa by now, but instead I just sit here alone. No one calls much these days, but anytime the phone rings, I think maybe the boy's coming home. It was a long time ago, another life that I had, a little boy who called me dad.
David Rovics, how much of your material is autobiographical?
Well, like in a way, it's a lot more of it is autobiographical than it seems. But in a way, most of it is not autobiographical. I just like to write in the first person. But I discovered that human emotions are universal. And so you can actually relate to anybody, no matter how different their experiences are than yours. You've had experiences that are related to theirs, and once you realize that, once you really viscerally realize that, then it opens up the world to write about from a personal perspective. And you can do it, of course, as a songwriter or a novelist or any number of other things. But once you know the subject material, even if it's unfamiliar subject material, of course, you have to do a lot of research to get to know it. But the emotions involved with the people who are part of the subject you're writing about are emotions that you can understand and feel and write from that emotional perspective. You know, and so it's just a matter of understanding the subject.
David Rovics, the troubadour, the philosopher. I'm glad you're here in the studios of Radio Curious.
Me too, Barry.
And before we close, I'd like to ask you about a eureka or an aha moment that influenced you, that gave you a philosophy.
There was that moment that that I discovered that you could. That actually human emotion is a universal thing and human experience is universal and that we can understand everybody else in the world if we make an effort and understand people in a really meaningful, deep, complete kind of way, if we let ourselves. And that was a real aha moment when I figured that out. And it opened up the world to me and as a songwriter and as a writer generally and as a person, really.
What would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I think about that a lot, you know, because the older I get, the more my friends keep dying and you know, natural thing that happens, you know, to everybody. And also the older I get, the more convinced I am that there really is only one precious life and that all this stuff about an afterlife and heaven and all this stuff is just people trying to delude themselves because they can't deal with reality. And which is totally understandable because reality is very, very harsh. You know, the idea that, you know, you only get to experience life for a certain limited period of time and then it's over and that's it. And you're dead. You're gone. You know, that that's tough because I want to live forever. And because I don't know anything else. This is all I know is this life on this earth, and there's so much that I want to do. It's so much I want to experience, and I know that I'm never going to get to experience even the most tiniest fraction of all that.
So,
I'm perfectly happy doing what I'm doing, and I have no particular plans to do anything else. I mean, if I can keep on writing songs and writing essays and making a living as a musician. Then and raising my daughter and, you know, I don't have any real higher aspirations than that.
And finally, David Rovics, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
The most recent book that I read cover to cover, which I thought was just fantastic and a book that really everybody should read, especially if you've ever had a childhood or if you ever have a child or are thinking about having a child, then this book, Raising Our Children, Raising Ourselves by Naomi Aldort. And, you know, they say that, you know, being a parent doesn't come with a handbook, but well, it actually does. And you just have to read it. And that's the book.
David Rovics, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you.
David Rovics describes himself as very much in the troubadour tradition, singing his own songs and those others have written. Based in Portland, Oregon, he spends most of his time on tour. The book he recommends is Raising Our Children, Raising Ourselves by Naomi Aldort. You may learn more about David Rovics at his website, www.davidrovics.com. This interview was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on December 9th, 2012. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.